Our next case is 2014-1966, Vernon Tribbett et al. Versus Barbara Shepherd et al. For the appellant, Mr. Warnock.
May it please the court, Madam Chief Justice, Justices of the Court, my name is Matt Warnock, and I represent the appellants and severed mineral interest owners in this case, which happen to be approximately 30 members of the Shepherd family. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This case is comprehensive. You have a lot of Dormant Mineral Act cases before you. This case has been narrowed to two narrow issues, a constitutional question and a statute of limitation question. But you really can't lose sight of two big picture principles. The first is, I'm going to adopt a quote from Chief Justice John Roberts. The cardinal principle of judicial restraint is that if it is not necessary to decide more, it is necessary not to decide more. And that couldn't be more true in this case. The only way you get to the constitutional question and the statute of limitations question, and frankly, what the 20-year look back is under the 1989 version of the Dormant Mineral Act, is if the court determines that the 1989 version is self-executing. As you know from prior arguments and briefing in a number of other cases, like most severed mineral interest owners, we believe that is not the case, that it is not self-executing. If this court holds that it's not self-executing, you don't have to go beyond that question.
Well, we've heard all those other cases, and they're parked at the moment. Presumably, we have decided how we would decide those cases. But then there is this lingering constitutional issue, which has them all parked. And you come here today and say, well, don't deal with that.
Well, our position is that
So we parked all of those cases for no good reason if we don't deal with this. Because if there's a fundamental constitutional issue, that affects everything.
And that's my second point. And you actually use the F word, the fundamental, because that's actually, if you get to the constitutional question and you're in this constitutional paradigm, that's the issue. You're dealing with a fundamental right here. What this court said in Norwood is that the right of private property is a fundamental right.
But Norwood involved the government taking.
Norwood was a takings case, but it's also this court's most comprehensive examination of what private property ownership is under the Ohio Constitution.
Don't you want to discuss the constitutional issue with us?
Absolutely.
Today?
I just want to. I'm framing my argument. I have two points.
So well, let's get to it.
All right. Let's get into it. So it's a fundamental right. Private property ownership is a fundamental right that has to flavor and is the backdrop for any constitutional analysis. So let's first talk about due process and the Texaco case, the United States Supreme Court decision from the 1980s, which most surface owners, including the appellees in this case, focus on.
Before we get to due process, did you raise due process below?
The due process was not specifically raised below.
And why would we address it now?
Well, I've got a couple of reasons that it should be addressed. First, the state constitutional issue has been before this court from the beginning. Due process may not have been specifically raised, but the unique posture of this case, I don't think that it actually needed to, because from the beginning, our argument has been that the 1989 version of the statute is ambiguous. One of the statutory factors is the consequence of any interpretation. If you're going to look at the self-executing interpretation, which has been raised in all of these cases, one of the unfortunate consequences is it's unconstitutional. Second, this court does have the discretion to decide a constitutional issue, and it's a similar standard to accepting the proposition of law.
But didn't you say if we don't have to address a constitutional issue, we do not address the constitutional issue?
Absolutely, and that's my first point is our position all along has been it's not self-executing. If you make that decision, you don't have to get to the constitutional
question.
Okay,
what happens if we make the decision that 1989 is not a self-executing statute?
If it's not self-executing?
Not self-executing.
Then the only version that applies is the 2006 version, and unless a surface owner took some action, like filing a quiet title, to actually implement the 1989
prior
version.
Prior to the...
Prior to 2006.
To 2006, June 2006. If nothing has been done, then 2006 controls.
Correct.
And so the parties find themselves in the same position, whether they were in 2008 or, you know, 1999.
Correct.
Okay.
Now, getting into the constitutional questions, to get back to the main issue before the court. Well, and sorry, Justice French, to finish the line of questioning, you have the discretion. In this case, we think that finality, the 15 cases before the court, you've accepted the proposition of law, everybody's had a full chance to brief it. And the reality is, if you don't decide it in this case, there's going to be another one of these cases, whether it's 2 months from now or 2 years from now, that you're going to have to decide the due process question.
Well, not if we decide that 1989 is not self-executing.
That's correct. And I'm assuming, for the sake of argument, that if you go down a different path, which we're not supporting, but if this court determines that it is self-executing, then that's the only way you get to the constitutional question.
But not in this case, because you didn't raise it.
We would argue that you do have the discretion if you hold it self-executing.
Well, the retroactivity was raised below.
The retroactivity is. And at the end of the day, our point is, if the 1989 version is self-executing, it violates the retroactivity provision of the Ohio Constitution and the due process provision of the Ohio Constitution. For retroactivity, the 1989 version of the Dormant Mineral Act is necessarily retroactive. It has a prospective and a retroactive application. It applies to mineral interests that were created after 1989, prospective, and to mineral rights that were created before 1989, which is retroactive.
What do you think is your best case to support your retroactivity?
The best case?
Mm-hmm.
The best is, this court has recognized that even if a statute operates in the future, but it looks back to take away a vested property right, it is retroactive. And the second prong of the analysis is it substantive. It impairs a vested right, or it adds a new burden to a right. And in this case, it would do both. It would not only impair, it would take away a constitutional, a fundamental right of private property ownership and give it to somebody else.
What case are you referring to?
It's the tobacco line of cases. And it's 127 Ohio State 3rd 511. It was a 2010 case. And that case actually talks about how this principle dates back to about five centuries and actually was incorporated into the Ohio Constitution in 1851. And then, so you have this impairment of a vested right and these additional burdens. Even the United States Supreme Court in Texaco recognized that there were new burdens being added to the mineral owner, having to do something, take a savings event, like filing a preservation claim or doing one of the other savings event, and then also monitoring changes in legislation, which is what they hung their hat on.
Does it matter the degree of burden? Because the act, the one that you would argue offends the Constitution, was promoted by the State Bar Association to undo certain other burdens on property owners, and that is these long forgotten separations of mineral ownership, in which the folks who retained it then forgot about it and did nothing to keep the record going forward at the local courthouse. And so it became problematic to have clear titles. And that was the genesis of it. And at the time it was done, the interest that could be severed, self-executing, were not thought to be particularly valuable. Now that's changed, and you have clients who now think they are pretty valuable, maybe less valuable today than they were a couple years ago. But does that matter?
Getting to your original question, I don't know that the burden matters for two reasons. First, the line of cases that this court has adopted is it's a burden. It's a new burden that didn't exist previously. But even more than that, the other piece of that is it's an or impairs a vested right. And so even if you don't think this burden is enough, which I don't necessarily agree with, it does impair a vested right, this fundamental right of property ownership, and takes it from the servant mineral interest owner to the surface owner.
Our fundamental rights of property ownership, they have some limitations as well, do they not? When the state was laid out, the counties and townships retained easements for highway purposes, and then over time those easements morphed into just utilities can come along and put their utility lines in where that highway easement was. So all of those represent, for the good of us all, limitations that can morph and grow on the basic fee simple ownerships. And might this not be looked at the same way? It was clearing an opportunity to clear titles that were being really clouded by the inactivity of the kind of folks that you represent.
Well, and that may have been one of the reasons that the statute was passed. But again, getting back to Norwood, which I'm not citing it for takings, but there's a strong protection of private property, cannot be trod upon lightly, no matter how great the weight of other forces. And you may have mentioned an interest of why the statute was passed, but it's a fundamental right. So unlike Texaco, we're in strict scrutiny. So is that interest, is the statute narrowly tailored to meet that interest? And I would say no. It's not only is it not narrowly tailored, it's a very broad application of this
principle. But at the time it was done, it was hardly trod upon lightly. You have the Bar Association, you have the Farm Bureau, you have the folks who want to develop these energy assets, all coming together and saying, we need to do something because these clouds on these titles make it impossible or difficult, problematic to develop
we had the
mineral interests.
The Bar Association put forth the legislation, and what happened to it from there, I'm not exactly clear, but the Bar Association is also who changed it in 2006 and added what I call the due process protections, the notice provisions. So when you're looking at this from a strict scrutiny standpoint, narrowly tailored is 2006, not 1989.
1989 must have proved unworkable in some respects, or we would not have had the 2006. We'd still only be talking about the 89.
And that's exactly right. And when you see you see what the Bar Association put out and Senator Wagner's testimony where he labeled it ambiguous and essentially unworkable because of that ambiguity.
And it has spawned all kinds of litigation once the avid interest in these mineral rights became a thing here in Ohio. 1989 didn't clarify anything.
1989 did not clarify anything. And in fact, there are 15 cases before this court in various phases. And, adding to that, if the court finds that this is a self-executing statute, there's going to be a lot more litigation
Isn't it entirely possible that what happened between 89 and 2006 is not that the statute was hard to read or unworkable, it was that the interests that were thought to be rather insignificant in value suddenly became valuable, and it became worth fighting over. And the legislature then looked at it and said, well, perhaps we ought to add some more process.
My answer to that is no, actually, because the shale boom didn't hit Ohio until 2010 and 2011, which is 4 or 5 years after this happened. So when 1989 and 2006 were put into play, it didn't have to do with the
people
value.
People weren't
of the
out
minerals.
Acquiring pan up for the purchase of those in 2006.
I can't speak to whether anybody was, but I can tell you that the leasing boom and the shale boom in Ohio did not take place until after 2010.
Some would urge that the adverse possession laws have stripped rights from people who thought they owned property. Is there an analogy in your view?
No, I don't think there is for a number of reasons.
And that would be
because why? Well, first of all, the state has argued that adverse possession is somehow akin to this act, and it's not. Adverse possession can apply to and does apply to severed mineral rights. But the biggest difference is adverse possession includes notice, open, notorious, and adverse. So you know. 1989 has nothing like that. There's not an analogy. And in fact, this court has said adverse possession is disfavored.
Well, 89 had a three-year period after it was passed, and as citizens, we're all charged with notice of anything the legislature does, whether we're aware of it or not. We're made responsible.
I appreciate that, but at the same time, I think under the Ohio Constitution, when you're dealing with the deprivation of a fundamental right, I don't know that that's enough. I know I've taken
that time. That's a real bottom line question, isn't it?
I'm sorry?
That's the real bottom line question, isn't it? Is your clients were on notice that the legislature acted, but is that enough? Are they entitled to something more than being responsible for knowing what the legislature did?
If you're focusing on due process, that is the question, but it also doesn't get past the retroactivity analysis.
Okay.
Thank you.
Counsel, I do need to ask a question in the last sentence, though. What about the 3 years that was granted by the legislature? Isn't that sufficient for due process? Telling the world there's a new law, you got 3 years, get moving?
I think getting back to my answer to this question, I don't think it is in this situation when you're dealing with a fundamental right under the Ohio Constitution. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chief Justice O'Connor, my name is Richard Meiser. I am representing the appellee in this particular case. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for my colleague, Mr. Peterson, who will be arguing on behalf of the Attorney General's office. One of the things that I want to establish in my argument before the court today, Your Honor, that we use a principle in real estate law, and that is a bundle of rights. And we sometimes refer to them as a bundle of sticks. And I'm going to be referring to those today because when we talk about oil and gas rights, we're talking about a bundle of rights that the surface owner has and a bundle of rights that the severed mineral interest owner has. And so I'm going to be referring to that. First of all, the appellants argue, Your Honor, that the 1989 Dormant Minerals Act is an unconstitutional retroactive taking when you look at the self-executing feature, and because it is retroactive, they argue that it is a violation of Article 2, Section 28 of the Ohio Constitution. Now, Your Honor, their first proposition is that this act is intended to be retroactive. It is not intended to be retroactive. I will concede that it is intended to look to the past to find a problem. And the problem was that vested mineral rights in a severed mineral interest owner in the past had become abandoned, had become forgotten, had become misused, had been put aside. And for many years, we didn't even know who these people were. The Dormant Minerals Act attempts to be able to put otherwise unproductive natural resources back into productive use. That's the public policy that is trying to be.
Okay, is that sufficient, the public policy, to do away with a specific notice requirement that is evidenced in a statute such as the 2006 version of the Dormant Mineral Act?
No, it is not, Your Honor. But I will submit to you that and I will jump to the due process argument. I will submit to you that the 1989 statute did provide sufficient notice. If you take,
you're saying the 89 statute provide notice to the
severed mineral
rights owners who have abandoned this, hadn't done anything in in years.
That's correct, Your Honor. The passage of the statute in 1989, coupled with the 3 years to allow those severed mineral interest owners to become acquainted with the statute and then to conform their actions in accordance therewith, is notice. It's notice sufficient for due process. If we look at Texaco versus Short.
There was no, so you're utilizing the same argument that Justice Pfeiffer asked of Mr. Warnock, that merely by the legislature passing this law and identifying a window and giving it till 92, that window, that's enough notice to deprive a citizen of their property?
Your Honor, I will submit to you the answer is yes. And I will point to the United States Supreme Court in Texaco versus Short supported that argument. They said that a severed mineral interest owner does not have to be given actual notice. That when examining the Indiana statute, they held that the passage coupled with a 2-year period is sufficient to give the severed mineral interest owner notice to satisfy due process.
When your clients acquired the property, was there a deed restriction reserving those mineral interests to another party, or were they granted to your client?
Your Honor, I appreciate your question. There was no reservation. My clients, Mr. and Mrs. Tribbett, they acquired the property in a deed in 1996 and in 2006, and there was no reservation there. However, there were some reservations, to be fair in this presentation. There were some other reservations in the chain of title, which brings us to another issue. As Mr. Warnock indicated, there are multiple issues in this particular case.
Those reservations were not reflected in the 96 or the 2006 deed that they acquired.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So, is that because the title company didn't look back far enough when they were creating the deeds, or whomever created those deeds of purchase?
Well, Your Honor, the deeds of purchase, Mr. and Mrs. Tribbett, at the time that they purchased, were interested in the surface interest. No, the mere fact that there is not a reservation for oil and gas in a deed doesn't mean that sometime in the past that there has been a reservation or a grant of oil and gas. And when the
title— Was there a deed in existence that reflected the severance of the mineral rights?
You're right, Your Honor. In 1960—
I'm asking a question. I'm not right. I'm asking a question.
The answer is yes. I'm sorry. The answer to your very good question is yes.
When was
in 1962—
1962, it said in black and white that the surface owner has divested the mineral rights to whomever.
That is correct.
Okay. Not ancient times. If you're doing a transfer, I mean, there it is in the records, and every deed subsequent to that should reflect that, correct?
No, Your Honor, not necessarily, and that's not the case in the chain of title when you're examining title. You may or may not find an exception to oil and gas or coal or other minerals if the parties are simply interested in transferring the surface. But if I may,
So you're saying that your clients took it with only the intention of utilizing the surface?
Well, they acquired the property, and they acquired all of the interests that were there. And the mere fact that there wasn't necessarily an exception in that deed doesn't necessarily mean that they weren't interested in the minerals beneath that surface. Your Honor, if I may, I would like to address the appellant's main argument is the retroactive taking. The Dormant Minerals Act doesn't, when the Dormant Minerals Act looks back and identifies that there has been an abandonment and identifies the fact that the severed mineral interest owner is not exercising dominion over their mineral interest and that it is abandoned, the Dormant Minerals Act doesn't stop there. If it did, if it stopped right there and said, if you're not using them, we're going to give them to the surface owner. If it stopped right there, yeah, it would be an unconstitutional taking, no question. But that's not what the Dormant Minerals Act did. The Dormant Minerals Act said, severed mineral interest owner, pick up your rights. And what we want you to do after 1989 is we want you to come forward and perform one of six saving events in this three-year period, going prospective. And if you do, then we will not deem your interest abandoned. But if you don't come forward, and if you don't do them, because of your inaction, we are going to deem you having abandoned and divested your interest. And when you divest it, we are then going to hold that the surface owner is now vested with these interests.
Counsel, let me ask you, as you're going along there, I'm here. Now, does that mean 20 years from 1989, or is that any 20 years in the history of man?
Your Honor,
take 1947, for example. If the land has been dormant from 47 to 67, is that a 20-year window, and is that sufficient for an abandonment?
The answer is no, Your Honor, because let's say 47 to 67, there's no action. Well, it hasn't been abandoned because the abandonment is not effective until 1992. In 1992, the abandonment is effective. So there could have been an abandonment in 1947, but all the way from 47 to 92, if the severed mineral interest owner doesn't do something, then it's going to be deemed abandoned and vests in the surface owner.
But now, if the mineral owner does something in 1950, okay, acquired it in 47 under Justice O'Neill. He does something in 1950. Does that preserve it until 92, or do you have to look at the 89 and go back the 23 years?
Your Honor, they could perform a saving event in 1950. They haven't abandoned it then. They could do another one in 1960.
Let's say 1950. That will preclude the operation of the 1989 law.
No, the 1989 law establishes that in 1992, when the statute became effective in 92, 20 years.
It didn't become effective in. Wait a minute. It gave you until 92 to do one of these six things.
Correct.
But you've got to look back 23 years.
I'm going to look back 23, whatever the period of
time
is.
So whatever you have done prior to those 23 years, if you're still not doing it in those 23 years,
it is deemed abandoned.
It's deemed abandoned.
Okay. But the other point that I need to make in the question is that what do we do in 1992? Do we stop in 1992 when we're examining the 20-year period? Well, we don't. When the General Assembly passes a statute, they do it for in a prospective manner. They didn't pass the statute to be effective in 1992. When 1993 came about, we're moving that 20-year period. But 94, we're moving that period and 95 until it is amended in 2006. And so that's how that 20 years that you were referring to is applied.
So your now, view is the 20 years commences in sometime in 1969 and it terminates in 92, and then it rolls year by year.
Your Honor,
until 2006.
And it has to.
Is that your view?
You're exactly right. And it has to, because when in 1989 the Dormant Minerals Act was passed, they didn't pass the statute just for one day. They passed it prospectively. Let me use another example. The Marketable Title Act. The Marketable Title Act says that if we have a 40-year period going back to the root of title, if I have an interest, whether it's an encumbrance or a lien or an interest in real estate, it has to be recorded in this period of time. And as time goes on, as time moves on, and my root of title changes, if my interest is back here, it's gone. It is automatically terminated.
What year did your clients acquire title to the property? There were two deed transactions.
Two deeds, Your Honor, and I'm pulling on my recollection now. I think it was 1996 was one of them, and 2006 was the other one.
And do you claim that in the first deed, your clients obtained all of the mineral interests, or do you claim that it was by operation of the statute that they acquired the
Well, it would have been, you see, their predecessors in title, whoever owned the property in 1992, and I don't recall who that was, this property has changed hands several different times, and whoever owned the property in 1992 acquired those mineral rights. And as they passed the property on, they also passed the ownership of the property on.
Counsel, you're well into your co-counsel's time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Peterson?
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. I'd like to make 3 points briefly, if I may, and I'd begin with questions that Justice French and Justice O'Donnell asked. And that turns on, you asked the appellants, what is their best case? And then Justice O'Donnell, you also asked a follow-up question about adverse possession. And we think certainly one of the best cases has to be the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Texaco, but also this court's decision in State XREL AAA Investments, in which it looked to the Texaco decision as a matter of Ohio constitutional law when it was interpreting Article 1, Section 19. But another line of court cases that I think is equally important is the court's precedent regarding the power of the General Assembly to amend the statute of limitations that applies to an accrued cause of action. And if you look at the Cook decision, the Gregory v. Flowers decision, Groach, the Taylor decision most recently, the court has recognized that even when a person has an accrued cause of action, the General Assembly may amend the statute of limitations, and that's a prospective action, even though it applies to a existing cause of action, as long as they leave a reasonable period of time in which you can bring that cause of action. And so here—
And what about notice under those other circumstances?
The court has never required notice under its statute of limitations cases. So while it has discussed retroactivity and due process, it has never found that the General Assembly or an individual has to provide notice to someone.
You weren't talking about property rights in the cases that you just cited there.
And that's the second point I wanted to get to, Your Honor, because there's been much discussion about the Norwood decision and its emphasis on property rights. And I think the strength of the Norwood decision, its real power, comes in its detailed discussion of the history of property rights in Ohio. And I think what our brief has shown is intertwined for hundreds of years with this concept of private property has been a concept that the General Assembly, that the legislature, that society writ large has a power to condition retention of a property right on use, that they can establish a statute of limitations. That's what adverse possession is. Indeed, it finds its voice in Ohio as
that,
a statute of limitations.
That Norwood stands for the proposition that as long as you're using your property, you can own it, and when you don't use it, you lose it?
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying that
Norwood's— I don't remember writing that.
No, what the court did write in Norwood, it did engage in a detailed historic analysis of our property right tradition. And intertwined with that, as the court recognized in its Ivanich decision, Ivanich v. Bridges, which postdated Norwood, is that adverse possession has had a venerable place in Ohio and in property law generally.
You think adverse possession is not disfavored?
Isn't
it a last resort? I mean, it's—
Your Honor, but it is something that is a key aspect of property law. It is the foundation of, as the
everybody knows about adverse possession, or at least they think they do. But that is not the preferred way to acquire property, and I believe that it is successfully used in very, very limited circumstances.
But even if it's disfavored, Your Honor, as the court recognized in Ivanich, as the U.S. Supreme Court recognized when it analyzed the Indiana Dormant Mineral Act, which significantly only provided a 2-year forward-looking period as opposed to the 3-year period that the Ohio General Assembly adopted after the fact.
Well, without actual notice, it really doesn't matter. I mean, if we adopt the fact that it's insufficient, the extension of time from 89 to 93 is merely, or 92, I think, I can't remember whether it was 92 or 93, but anyway, just the inclusion of that bit of time without more is insufficient to deem notice to the mineral rights owner.
Two responses, Your Honor. One, that would be inconsistent with all of the court's precedent on the ability to amend statute of limitations. And two, this isn't just a 3-year notice period, because in 1992, the first time a property had been abandoned, not only would it have been had to be unused for 23 years, but property owners knew as of 1973, which is when mineral interest became subject to the Marketable Title Act, that they could lose that interest through inaction. And so really, you're not looking at just a 3-year period of notice telling property owners that they need to do something. You're looking at 1973, when the Marketable Title Act said, well, if these certain circumstances are met, you can lose a mineral interest.
Counsel, let me ask you then to address the chief's question earlier on. What about if a 1947 lease, something happens in 1950? Does that start the rolling of the statute again?
Your Honor, the answer to that question is the period of time you would need to look at is the 23 years preceding 1992. And so what happens in 1940, what happens in 1950 is not going to be relevant for purposes of the 1989 version of the Dormant.
So you're saying if they did something in 50 to perfect their right, they have to do something in another 20 years as well?
Excuse me with the math, but generally, yes. Yeah, I may not be quite correct on where the 20-year periods fall, but yes, they would need to do something in the 23-year period prior to 1992. And that, again, the 3-year period going to the retroactivity clause question, which we contend is the only one that has been properly presented, and should the court decide to go beyond that, it should do so as a matter of judicial grace, because process does matter. And so looking to that three-year period is what the U.S. Supreme Court said in Wilson v. Isinger that makes a statute prospective in operation, and the court itself in its, like I said, in its statute of limitation cases has said that as long as there is a reasonable time to take action on your accrued rights, that it is not going to be a retroactive or a due process problem.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you've used your time. You may take a minute.
Just 2 points. First, the great irony of this case is that there's going to be a severed mineral interest no matter what, because the Tribbetts have sold the surface. Getting to the deeds in question that you mentioned, Chief Justice, there were the severance deed in 1962, and then there were two subsequent transfers which specifically referenced the mineral rights in 1982 and 1992. So if you had done even cursory title, you would have discovered that not only was there a reservation, you would have found the language and the specific reference to the volume and page number.
Well, but none of that really matters, does it, in terms of what we're being asked to decide?
Well, sure it does, because...
Well, but we're looking at cases where, sure, the surface owner knows or should, is responsible for knowing that there's a severed interest.
But they want to take advantage of the inaction of the mineral owners, so even if it's staring them in black and white when they purchase in, 1988 or even subsequent to that, so what? Then the further inquiry, according to the appellees, is what was done in the 20 years prior to 1992.
Right. And even worse than that, they're arguing for this rolling look forward, is what I'll call it, which Judge DeGennaro below described as the most arbitrary interpretation of the 1989 version of the statute. So that in and of itself violates due process.
So again, if I try to recap your argument, is it necessary in your view that we make a declaration in this case regarding the self-executing nature of the 89 Act?
That's the threshold question in this case, and I think all of the
in
cases.
In your view?
Yes.
And
thank you.
If we resolve that, how would you have us resolve this case? Let me ask you that, because we've talked all over the Constitution on this.
I'm happy to answer that.
And if
that.
We resolve that.
You told us that moment you opened your mouth.
The 1989 version of the Dormant Mineral Act is not self-executing and required some sort of legal.
And limit. Never move to the constitutional issue.
Correct.
That's where you are.
I think if you answer that question that way, you do not have to answer the constitutional question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement, gentlemen, and you'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you call a recess?